Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you here on this Monday, August the 3rd, 2020. First show for us in the month of August, 8-3-20. 16 coming up on 17 minutes past the hour. And again, we want to thank Tim Streed from the Ohio High School Athletic Association for being on in hour number one to talk about the future of high school sports in the fall. And again, we want to thank the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams, for being live in studio with us on Friday for 5 hours, as well as the 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow, for coming in on Friday and discussing the chain shortage, and the amazing Kriskin for calling in Friday, who was on Johnny Carson and David Letterman for so many years. And I do want to let everybody know, I don't think we're going to have the time to get it in today, but legendary actor Wilford Brimley from such movies as Philadelphia with Tom Hanks and Cocoon with Don Ameche and Jessica Tandy, and of course he was on Seinfeld as the Postmaster General and the spokesperson for Quaker Oats for so many years and Liberty Medical, passed away Saturday at the age of 85. He was on this show a lot over the years, and we do have a clip of an interview with Wilford from December the 1st, 2015. It was a Christmas interview. He recorded "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" for us, but he also talked about a lot of other things in his career. I don't think we're going to get to that today, but we're going to have that for you tomorrow. So the clip in tribute to Wilford Brimley tomorrow morning here on WWGH Radio. Also, don't forget tomorrow, Marion Public Health Commissioner Tracy Kinsler will be on at 8:10 a.m. making her regular every other week stop. And we're going to talk to her about public schools. As you heard on the news report this morning, Dr. Ron Arusi, superintendent of the Marion City Schools, was on this program last Thursday and said the final call is up to her if the kids should go back to school at all, or is it going to be all remote? Well, we'll have Tracy on tomorrow morning at 8:10 a.m. to find out what she thinks with just a matter of days before the kids are supposed to go back to school. So there you have it. This hour is going to be a lot of fun, because it's always great to have authors on this program, and this is an author we have never had on the program, but he is an Ohio author, so certainly we do appreciate that. His book is Blood on the Chesapeake. The author is Randy Overbeck, and it's a pleasure to welcome any author to these microphones. Anybody who writes a book, that's a big process. Randy, how are you?
I'm doing great this morning.
Randy, how did the idea come up to write this book?
I have been, there were several factors that kind of drove me to write this book. I had been working on the idea of setting a series of books in very resort locations, because I like to visit a lot of places, and our very favorite place was on the Eastern Shore, so that's where I chose to write this particular book. I'm an educator, having served the children of Ohio for 39 years as a teacher, a college professor, and a school leader. So I decided to make my hero a teacher. So those two pieces came together, and then I decided that I wanted to focus the story on, even though it had to be historic because it takes place 20 years ago, I wanted to focus the story on current issues. And I chose for the first book the current issue of racial injustice. Those pieces all kind of came together.
Now, just to give the listener perspective here, racial injustice, clearly what's going on right now in the country since Memorial Day weekend with the killing of George Floyd has been racial injustice typified. When was this book written?
The book was published in April of last year, April 28, 2019. And, of course, I probably wrote it for the put it together over 18 months, 20 months prior to that. So I obviously didn't have any connection or knowledge or foresight about the current current movement, but I racial injustice was an issue that I've been concerned about for a long time, and so I decided to make that the focus of the book, and it just happens to coincide with what's going on, one of the real crucial issues in the country right now.
It's a very interesting book. I got it late last week. Tell people the premise of this book.
The premise, the nugget of the story is that a high school teacher decides to move to the Eastern Shore to kind of get away from some personal issues. He lived in Michigan, native of Michigan, born and raised, a white guy, and he moves to the looking for a teaching and coaching job and finds that on the Eastern Shore of the Chesapeake Bay. I invent a town called Wilshire, but I've actually set the town among other real actual towns in on the Eastern Shore. And he comes to this town and finds an absolutely gorgeous place. For those who haven't been there, the Eastern Shore of the Chesapeake Bay is clearly one of the undiscovered gems in the United States. It's a gorgeous place with beautiful sunsets, incredible sailing, a wonderful culture for the most part, and he thinks he's kind of struck gold. He's got the perfect job. He's very successful as a football coach, falls in love, but he's not there very long before he's bothered by a ghost. He happens to be a sensitive, which means he can see people on the other side that other individuals can't. And to make a long story short, the ghost turns out to be the ghost of a student that was murdered at the high school some 30 years earlier. Much of the book is involved with him trying to unravel the mystery between what happened to this ghost and then eventually trying to bring those responsible to justice.
Mm. Take me through the process of coming up with a plot and characters and a story for a book like this.
Well, I am what's called, I am a mix between a plotter and a pantser. And I'm not sure if you've interviewed enough authors that you know those two terms, but a plotter is somebody who sits down and organizes the entire plot of the book in an outline or sometimes on a display board, chapter by chapter, character by character. A pantser is literally somebody who kind of has an idea, sits down at the keyboard and just starts hammering away. I find myself kind of in the middle of those two. I always start with several things that I have a pretty clear understanding of. In this case, the area was my first choice. The second one was the character. I fashioned my characters after real people that I've known. After 39 years in education, I have had the good fortune of working with thousands of teachers, parents, principals, board members, and I use characteristics of those to create my fictional characters. And then I kind of search for a something that would make it more than just a interesting whodunit, and that's where the theme comes in. That's where the issue of racial injustice comes in. When I did my research on the Eastern Shore, I found out that, much to my surprise, that the Eastern Shore had actually had two lynchings in its history, which had largely been covered up, and I decided to kind of wrap that into the story of the book. So those three pieces I tied together, found an actual school building that I could use as an example for the story, actually found the building in one of my travels in Maine, and put all of those pieces together into what I hope is a coherent narrative. Excuse me. Frog in my throat.
That's okay. You talked about some things in the book that are factual, but overall the book
is a work of fiction. Is it hard to weave those two together once you get started writing the book? Because there are certain things about fact you just can't change.
Yes. Is it hard? I think the answer is kind of a yes and no. I try to be very true to the location. So for those who have lived or visit this area, they will find my description and my characterizations of the individuals there very spot on. I've actually heard that from a number of my readers, some of whom even live in the area, and said, "Boy, you really nailed that." So in that aspect, I try to be very careful with the factual details. I also work very hard to try to replicate what that area looked like in the time of the book. So this particular story takes place in 1998. So I had to work hard with people that I knew from the area, contacts I had from the area, to make sure all of those factual pieces are in place. I used the example of the story of the lynching just as one example of fact-based background as part of the background in the book. So once I started with those things, then I select and create the narrative, the fictional narrative that actually drives the story. You are correct. The book is almost all fictional. It's only set in a very real place, and it's set around real issues that happen in that area. But the actual story that I've used is purely from my imagination. It says that in the beginning of the book.
Is it important for you as an author to have points of fact in a good murder mystery?
Well, you know, Scott, I kind of never stopped being a teacher, so I always treat my fiction as I would have treated my class instruction, that people can learn something from this. So in this case, my hope is that the reader will come away with an appreciation of the really beautiful the facts of the area around that, in that area, and get an enjoyment of that. I sincerely, from the beginning, hope that the use of the theme of racial injustice, that it would be a very mild way of reminding readers of what that might look like for somebody coming in from outside. And I work really hard to make sure that those kinds of facts were accurate. I won't swear that I'm always 100% correct, but I do a great deal of research to make sure that's true. Here's an example of the factual part that I wanted to make sure was real. If those who have read the book know that there are a good number of chapters that take place on the water, on the Chesapeake Bay. In fact, that's one of the things that really makes this area beautiful. I've told audiences that one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen is sailing on the Chesapeake Bay about the first week of October, surrounded by incredible foliage changing colors around you. But I'm not a sailor, so I had to work very hard and do a lot of learning about the requirements and the expectations and what really happened on the water and how deep is the Chesapeake Bay and what would a good day and a terrible day look like on the Chesapeake Bay as far as weather goes. And yes, it was very important for me to try to make sure to get all of those details correct. I even sent some early versions of the book to some sailing experts who were very quick to tell me which areas I had wrong and how to correct those. So I think that's a perfect example of trying to get the facts right. I think readers enjoy it more if they go, "Oh yeah, that makes sense. That sounds like how that would work."
We're chatting with Randy Overbeck, author of the book Blood on the Chesapeake. Randy, when you're writing this book, being a teacher, is it, even though it is a mystery, is it teaching a lesson when it comes to race, in your opinion?
My hope is that it is. The way I look at this is that I've worked very, very hard and put a great deal of effort, skill, research, everything to make to create this book and to get it through a publisher. So I thought, if I'm going to go to all that work, then it should be more than just a brief escape. It should be more than just a fun puzzle, which is what all mysteries are at their center. And it should be more than a beach escape. It should actually, people should come away with some questions, at least, maybe not answers, but some questions that they did not have before. And I decided that in this first book in the series, I chose racial injustice to be that area that I wanted to ask questions about. My successive books focus on a different social issue. But the first one, I wanted to be racial injustice because I figured that to be most pressing right now.
Why do you think that in 2020 that is still the most pressing issue?
Well, I don't know that I am much of an expert to be able to give that answer, except that I can speak from my own experience. So, as I mentioned in the op-ed that's been published in a couple of papers in Ohio, I'm a white guy that was born in a very conservative, very white enclave area. I didn't know that at the time. My family was poor, but everyone I knew, all the connections I had were white. I didn't even see my first African-American interaction probably till high school, and even that was rare. It wasn't really until about 20 and 30th year in working that I started to get a glimpse of what I now recognize as sometimes covert racism. Unintended racism that we often have because we don't know the other. It wasn't until I completed my career at Xenia where I had encountered with a large number, good number of African-Americans, both in my work and then with the students that I served and the parents that I worked with, that I began to understand that kind of perspective. I think the reason we're still having that trouble is because there are literally millions of individuals like me that have been segregated, not in the old traditional sense, but segregated just because of our activities. So we never have any serious one-on-one interactions with people of minority culture. And as long as that continues, it's very, very difficult to jump across that bridge. I was fortunate enough to have good friends that helped me lead me across that bridge and be able to see what it looks like on the other side. But until that, it's really tough to have other people to understand other people's experiences.
Go ahead.
I think that's why.
It's interesting because this book, as you said, was published prior to what started back on Memorial Day of this year. When that started, and the fact, and I heard somebody talking about this last night, that it's still going on. We are now in the beginning of August. That this was not a moment, like a lot of these issues have been on race in the last 40, 50 years, that this has actually become a movement that is not stopping at all, and things are changing that have been certain ways for hundreds of years. When this started to happen, what did it make you think in regard to this book?
Well, to be very honest, that was not the first thing that came to my mind. I started getting emails from people who had read my book and reminded me that my book was really what some of what the conversation was about. Now, my book is not about Black Lives Matter. My book doesn't really speak with any authority at all from any kind of African-American perspective. My book is really about what happens to a white guy of privilege when he finds out he encounters some kind of racism, and then what does he do about that? That's always been the premise on which I built my book, and that's just one of the issues that has percolated through the Black Lives Matter movement, is that people like me getting to a point where they're realizing that they're recognizing racism, but in the past didn't bother to do anything about it, didn't didn't object and raise the issue. Now, in my case, in my book, it's a much, I make it a much bigger deal for my protagonist Daryl, because he has to make a decision whether he wants to push this envelope and open this Pandora's box that may end up actually costing him his life and even the life of the woman he loves. So it's a very big deal for him, much bigger than it is for most people. But I was hoping that would drive home that point about, well, maybe we better look at this from a different with a different lens.
When you're creating the characters in your book, where do they come from in your mind?
Most of the characters, most of the characters come from my own experience. As I mentioned, you know, I spent 28 years running school districts, and responsible from anywhere from 50, 70 adults to 600, 900 adults. So I worked with a lot of people. And over the years, that gave me a very big wealth of individuals to draw from. Now, I will tell you that most of these people, teachers, custodians, principals, board members, cafeteria workers, nearly all of those people have their heart in the right place. They are only there because they care about kids, or this is what they've always wanted to do with their life, or whatever. But I've also had more than a few that's not the case. They had ulterior motives, or they were lazy, or they're trying to get the easy way out, or in some cases for board members, it was a political move. So I've got a pretty good range of good guys and bad guys that I've dealt with in 39 years. So it's easy for me to draw from some of those experiences to take this characteristic from this person and this facial feature from this person, and then create the characters. My main character is kind of based on a teacher that I work with, but it doesn't look like the teacher. But he has the drive the teacher had and the interest the teacher had and stuff. So that's kind of, and then I kind of make him up according to how I want him to function in the story. Because of all my experience with all these teachers and seeing them over the years, it gives me a big well to draw from to be able to create what I hope is credible characters.
When you sit down to write a book, do you know the ending?
No, I don't. When I mentioned about being a plotter and a pantser, well, one of the things that I make sure that I do for each of my stories is that in the case of the mysteries, this is the first of a trio of mysteries called the Haunted Shores Mysteries. And in each one of these, I make sure that I have not decided who the bad guy is until I get close to the end. I make sure that there are multiple antagonists, any of whom could be the bad guy, the one who does it. And I try to leave that open so that as I get closer to the end of the book, it kind of comes to me. Oh, it needs to be this guy. This is the one that it fits. I might have some idea about that when I start, but I'm never certain about that. And as I write the book, I try to make sure that I've laid enough breadcrumbs so that it could be any of the three or four possible culprits as the reader is going through and trying to solve the mystery with me. Now I will have much of the rest of the book. In this particular case, I probably had maybe half of the book conceptualized before I sat down to write it. As another example, I have there's a scene in the story where Daryl almost drowns in the Chesapeake Bay. That was not one I had in mind. It just kind of came. It seemed to be a logical development of some of the earlier scenes that I had in there. So that's the kind of interaction I have with the story and the plot as I'm moving through my process.
In a mystery, it seems who's ever writing it for television or movies or a book, you either have two choices. You have the obvious choice, or you have the person who is the least likely choice. As you said, you don't really know until you get to the end of the book. Does that ever play in? Do you say, well, the way I've written this, this is the most likely person, and that's why I'm not going to choose them? Or do you say, that's why I'm going to choose them?
Well, sometimes I do both, actually. You know, so sometimes, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but it has now become, certainly I don't want to use the word cachet, but it now becomes kind of routine that the person who's the least likely suspect is the one who ends up being the bad guy. So I try as much as I can to veer away from the obvious. I'm not sure I'm always successful at that, but I try to do that. And like I said, what I try to do is I try to make sure that I at least have three people who, in the reader's mind, have enough culpability that they could well be the one who's most responsible for the murder and end up doing that. I do keep, what you said is exactly what I do keep in mind. So will the reader go, oh my God, well, it's so freaking obvious, how I could see that coming a mile away? Sometimes, I do worry about that, and I do work on that. But sometimes, because it's the obvious one, the reader has kind of been trained to go, well, it can't be that person, it's too obvious. So I may use that reverse psychology in putting the mystery together.
You know, when I talk to most actors and painters, anybody in the arts really, they work as much as they can, they rehearse as much as they can, they work on the script as much as they can, and they perform it to the best of their ability, but when it's done, it is done, and they never, most at least, never seem to be quite 100% happy with what they do. Is that the same for an author?
Yeah, I think it is the same. If you're honest about your craft, I think it is the same. I did try to put everything, and I used every skill I possibly could. I used the resources I had to try to make the book the very best I could. But I'll be really honest, I have read the book a year or so after it was published and looked at it and went, you know, I probably could have tweaked this a tiny bit here, and I could have added this, because if you're really committed to your craft, you're always working to get better. You're always working to do one step better. And what I try to do is I try to use that lesson in successive books. So the things that I thought I might have been able to improve slightly in Blood on the Chesapeake, I tried to put into the second book, at least from a skill point of view, of Crimson at Cape May. So I think that's correct. I think if you are not, I have heard actors say, I've never looked at that movie after I made it. I'm not able to do that. You know, I've found myself pick the book up and look at a chapter here and there and think about, okay, did that work the way I wanted it to? Is there something I can learn from that from the next one? Of course, I've not made up, you know, 50 movies like some actors have, and I can see why they might do that. But at least that's how it works for me.
Is there an overall lesson in this book, without giving away the ending, when the reader reads it, is there a lesson?
I would hope so. You know, I would hope the lesson that I'm hoping to impart is the lesson around coming to grips with racial injustice. Without giving away the book, the story is a little easier it is not very pedantic. It is not in your face, because the racial injustice that Darryl is dealing with has occurred 30 years earlier. That's not giving anything away. The reader learns that very, very early in the book. So he is trying to undo an injustice that occurred long ago, which is a much easier task to deal with than an injustice that you see happening today. Here's a perfect example. I bet you would have a very difficult time finding anyone, white or any color, that can look at the scene of what happened on the Edmund Bettis Bridge in Montgomery in Selma, and watch those protesters being hosed down, beaten, and hardly anyone today would say, "Man, well, they deserved it, man. I shouldn't have been on that bridge." But today, you will still hear people who go, "Well, George Foreman shouldn't have resisted arrest," or So it's much easier to deal with something that's further in the past. I understand that. But the lesson is still the same, whether it happened in May, or in my case, in the story, it happened in 1964. Racial injustice is racial injustice, and if we have courage, we learn to be able to stand up and go, "No, that's not okay. You can't treat other people like that." That's the essential lesson that I'm hoping comes across by the time the reader closes the book.
Again, we're chatting here this morning with Randy Overbeck, author of Blood on the Chesapeake. Randy, there's something I wanted to talk about here. Obviously, a lot of people come from different professions and write books, become authors. But it seems to me that there's something about people in the education field. Now, not that all of them become authors, but I have known so many teachers and so many people who just work in education in some way who have a written book or a partially written book in their life somewhere. Now, some get published, some are never worked on again, and they go on to other careers. You, coming from the education industry, what would you say to those people?
Well, I first of all, I think it's something that you that is important to you. You know, I cannot underestimate how challenging it is to write and a really strong book and get that book published. It is a daunting world in book publishing today. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but you know, there are hundreds of thousands of books that are released every week on Amazon. Amazon is carrying 8 million titles at any one time. So to wade into those waters is in fact a daunting challenge. So the first advice is, make sure this is what you want to do. And then if the answer is yes, and it was in my case, it was yes, I wanted to be a writer since I was a teenager. Then you work at it the very best way you can. Even though writing is a solitary activity, I never do it solely alone. So, for example, Scott, when I'm writing a book, I assemble a team of beta readers, somewhere around 15 readers all over the country, who will look at my book in process and give me feedback of what they think is working or not working. In this case, I've tried to make sure I had African-American readers, along with teachers, along with non-teachers who the beta readers for the book, and gave me feedback on that. And that's part of my process to make sure that the book is as good as it can be. I work with a writing group who help me improve my craft as it goes along, and all those pieces make things work, I think. So my advice to the other educators or those in education who have a story is that if it's something that's important to you, do the work and get it to the point where it's worthy of being shared with other people. I think the common element that you are mentioning is that nearly all of us in education have great stories. One of my biggest regrets, which I had thought about at the time, but I was too busy, was that I wish I had kept a journal from the first days in my education, because there are so many stories that I have had and lost in that time. Because virtually everything you can think of happens at school. You know, rapes, murders, everything eventually comes to the schoolhouse. So there's an incredible wealth of stories that you can draw upon if you have that background.
what is the measure of success of a book or an author? Is it financial? Is it feedback from people in the world? What's the measure of success?
Well, I think for different authors would give you a different answer. I am sophisticated enough and far enough along in my life to tell you that it is not and never will be financial success. The structure of the publishing world is such right now, Scott, that if you're not one of the big names, you have very little chance of getting any kind of serious financial success. So instead, I think what for me is a measure of success is the response the book is able to garner from the reader. You know, I've been very fortunate. My book has a 4.9 rating on Amazon and a 4.7 rating on Goodreads, which tells me a lot of people really, really like this book. And as I shared with you, it's earned 5 stars from 5 different professional review organizations and a couple of national awards. So that validates my work very much and keeps me going on to the next book. For me, that is a measure of success. When those things no longer happen, when readers are not enjoying the book, when it's not getting any positive reaction, I'll probably decide that it's time for me to move on.
What did you learn from writing this book?
What did I learn? I learned a lot. I learned a lot of different, if you wanted to say, well, what was your central lesson? I'm not sure. But for example, I learned more about the Chesapeake Bay and sailing than I ever knew in my life. I learned more about, I did a lot of research on lynchings. Again, not something we taught in schools, not something that I made sure, to be perfectly honest, was in the curriculum that I was in charge of when I was in charge of schools. But I didn't realize this, but one of the things that I learned was that in most of the towns, many of them in the north, not just in the south, that where Negroes had been lynched, where blacks were lynched in the mainly 20s and 30s, but lynchings actually occurred up through to the 40s and the 50s and even into the early 60s. In almost every town where the lynching occurred, according to historical records, the lynching was attended by scores to hundreds of people. It was an event to be seen. Yet, a generation after that happened, when historians go back and write, they could never find someone who was at that lynch. Community members would, when pressed, admit that, yeah, I remember that happened, but I didn't know anything about it. So this collective ignorance that the town assumes became the shroud that I used to put my book in. The fact that what often happens in a town, happened in a town not very far from here in Indiana, where there was a lynching, that everybody denied it later. So that kind of collective denial, that collective amnesia that occurs after this horrific event, that was something I had not heard of before. That was another real lesson that I had learned. So part of what I brought to the book about my understanding about racial injustice got further developed and filtered and clarified, and that probably was the most important lesson for me.
When you are writing a book, coming up with an idea, putting it down on paper, having people look at it, editing it, coming up with the ending, sending it off to the publisher, when the book finally comes and is in your hand with a cover on it, bound and ready to be sold, what's that experience like?
I tell you, it's like nothing else. It's certainly not as good. It can't compare to having a kid, but it's a little tiny little version of that. Because of all the work that you put into it, to see it to come into final fruition, it is a remarkable sense of accomplishment. Now, that accomplishment means nothing if when it goes out and nobody likes it, or you don't get a response, or it doesn't sell, none of those things happen. But still, having that first book in when that so the book was released in April of 19, the book probably hit my hands in February of that year. That was the first time I had that. And to see the final piece in my hand was a real sense of accomplishment, a real sense of gratitude that I had the ability and the time and the luck to be able to get this out at, you know, and have it so that people could enjoy it. It was a great experience.
Now, Randy, if people want to get Blood on the Chesapeake, how do they do that?
Well, the Blood on the Chesapeake is available at any of your booksellers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, any. It's available in local bookstores, but not readily available. It depends on their area. They can go to any of those sites and simply put Blood on the Chesapeake or put my name in, Randy Overbeck, and it will come up. I need to mention the second book has just now, it was released last week. It's called Crimson at Cape May, and it follows our main characters to a new location, Cape May, New Jersey, which happens to be the most haunted seaport on the Eastern Shore, where he encounters another serious murder and that Daryl has to uncover. So they can find both of those books now available either in e-version, Kindle, Nook, Apple iBooks, or in print.
Randy, before I let you go, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about this, you being an educator in Ohio, and here we are in the midst of the pandemic that we're in right now. Schools maybe are going to be going back, maybe not. At this point, what's your feeling on that?
Well, let me tell you, my first feeling is that I'm really, really glad I'm not having to make those decisions, because a few years ago, I would be the one having to make that call. I am very worried, to be perfectly honest, Scott, because in my experience, kids, there are no better sharers of any kind of illness than kids. My wife, when I was first a teacher, it happened to me, and then when my wife was a teacher in 23 years, every fall she'd come home with something new. There'd be some flu, some cold, something that she would pick up from the kids. So I do not understand how we are going to get kids back together and not spread coronavirus. Then, to make matters even worse, schools are all expected to do all these extra steps, and they have actually less money because of the tax changes. They have less money than what they've had in the past. Maybe they'll get some help from Congress. I know they're debating about that right now, but I don't know. My thought is that many of the districts will go back. I'm in Lebanon, and my grandchildren are going back in 2 weeks, and they're excited about doing that. I suspect that by October or November, we may be back home again. That's my guess.
That's a very interesting prediction. Again, the guest has been Randy Overbeck. The book is Blood on the Chesapeake. And Randy, before we go, again, if there's that teacher, if there's that author, would-be author out there listening right now, in one word, if they have not tried to get their book published, finished their book, done what they need to do to take those steps, and they really want to do it, what would you say to them?
Either go to a writer's conference or find a writer's group. It'll help you move in the direction that you would want to move.
Perfect. Randy, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. I hope you can come back. Good luck with the second book, and I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the time on the air.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Again, we want to thank our guest this morning, Randy Overbeck, author of Blood on the Chesapeake, an Ohio author, and in hour number one, Tim Streed from the Ohio High School Athletic Association, giving us the word on where fall sports is. We did not get to our Wilford Brimley tribute today. Wilford was on this program on December 1st, 2015, passed away Saturday at the age of 85. We'll definitely do that tomorrow, as well as be joined by Tracy Kinsler from the Marion Public Health Department. And remember, as Dr. Ron Arusi told us last Thursday, superintendent of the Marion City Schools, when he was on, the final call
on going back to school will come from Tracy Kinsler. So we will see where that is tomorrow. News here on this station, and we hope you enjoy that. Mid-morning coffee break with Adam Lepp is on right after this program. Voices of a People with Linda Sims today at 4:10 p.m. and the Mike Wilson Show at 5:10 p.m. Don't you dare go anywhere. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
I will do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. But it just stop me talking and I keep going.
To the oldest working actor in Hollywood, 101-year-old Norman Lloyd.
Now, did you like that, Norman, when that edict came down? Did you like to be told to stop driving?